Hi, this is Eric Schlein of the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today's episode of the Intelligent Investing Podcast is sponsored by Red Rock Running. Runners and joggers out there, tell me if this sounds familiar. You go into your local running store to pick up some gear, first the shirt, and as you browse the shirts, you see that nice, high-quality performance shirt running you at least $40. Then, you need something to carry your smartphone so you can listen to the Intelligent Investing Podcast while you run. Or maybe you want to track your run with a GPS. A smartphone carrier costs something like $20 or $30. And between work, family, and other responsibilities, the only chance many of us have to go for a run is early in the morning or late at night. That often means running in the dark. So, to help stay safe, you need a reflective vest to increase visibility. That's another $10, $15. So, in total, you can expect to spend over $100 just for gear that goes on your upper body. Red Rock Running has a better way. Their new Bryce running shirt combines all three of those products into one simple item. Secure pockets built directly into each sleeve carry your smartphone or other audio device, a couple of keys, headphones, or energy gels. Strategically placed, reflective material increases your visibility, keeping you safe when running in the dark. Intelligent Investing Podcast listeners know the importance of value. Purchasing a technical shirt, smartphone carrier, and a reflective vest separately costs over $100. The Bryce running shirt, however, gives you all three for only $59. And Red Rock Running is offering listeners this podcast an additional 15% off any purchase by using the promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So that's right, listeners, if you are a listener of the Intelligent Investing Podcast, you get an additional 15% off any purchase of a shirt that's already a good value by using that promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So remember, go to Red Rock Running, REDROCK, running.com, and receive 15% off your Bryce running shirt with promo code INVESTINGPOD, INVESTINGPOD. Carry more, increase visibility, decrease hassle.
Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett, here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein. You're listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, episode 16. Today we have Christian Olesen on, who runs the Olesen Value Fund, LP. Welcome to the show, Christian. Did I say your last name correctly?
Yes, you did. Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, where are you from, by the way? Where's that last name? What's your ethnicity? Just out of curiosity.
Yeah, so I was born and raised in Denmark.
Okay.
And I came to the U.S. Now it's like 19 years ago. In 1998, to go to college.
Oh, right on. So you still have a little bit of the accent. So
Absolutely. I've been in the U.S. for just about as long as I lived in Denmark now. But and I would consider my English better than my Danish, actually. But yeah, the accent sticks, I guess.
How do you say something in Danish? I've never heard Danish before.
Mit navn er Christian.
What did you say?
I just said my name is Christian.
Oh, right on. Well, if I wanted to say welcome to the show in Danish, how would I say that?
You just say velkommen til showet.
I'm not even going to try to repeat that, but welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into investing? How did you start your fund? How did that all come about?
Yeah. So you know, when I was an undergrad at Wharton, I was a finance major and an accounting major, and I was certainly interested in investing, but initially I was not totally sold on going into investing. I thought that going into private equity was the way to go for me, and I'd say in large part it was really because I didn't necessarily understand or believe how to beat the market. And, you know, I was certainly familiar with Buffett, but I think at the time I didn't quite see it. I did have a friend there who, you know, was a huge and still is a huge fan of Buffett's, and he definitely introduced me to a lot of Buffett's ideas, and so, you know, over time I just became more and more fascinated with the markets and with investing, and you know, after my first job, which was in it wasn't in the markets as such. It was working for a financial advisory firm called Stern Stewart. They're best known for the EVA, Economic Value Added Concepts. After I worked there for a couple of years, I finally decided that I was going to go into the markets or investing. And you know, it's been great ever since.
And what had you choose the markets over doing private equity?
You know, I think there are a few different reasons. Initially when I was much younger and I didn't know very much, I thought that private equity would make a lot of sense because, you know, I felt that in private equity you can make a tangible difference to the companies that you control, and I found that appealing. Whereas, you know, as a public markets investor, I didn't really see how you could add value, and like I said before, I didn't really understand, you know, how people like Buffett were able to beat the markets. But I think public markets are more interesting for a number of reasons. One is that, you know, it's much easier to be entrepreneurial, like being a small fund manager like me, whereas in private equity, you can't really do that. You have to be pretty big. And also, I think in the public markets, you know, essentially what I do is, you know, I try to find businesses that I can value with some reasonable degree of accuracy. And accuracy is not really the right word because it's very difficult to value a business. And then when the stock price is temporarily significantly below what I estimate the fair value to be, then I buy it. And, you know, when that's no longer the case, we sell. You know, in a nutshell, that's really what we do. We really just take advantage of the fluctuations in stock prices. In private equity, it doesn't work that way. You don't have an opportunity, usually, unless it's distressed, but usually you don't have an opportunity to buy a business when the supply of shares is temporarily in imbalance with the demand for shares, you know, which can drive the price down. In private equity, you have auctions, and as a result, you always end up paying a fair price, if not more than fair. So I think that's a little bit of a problem with the private equity business model.
Interesting. And how long have you been running your fund for?
So the fund has been in existence for you know, almost 9 years.
Oh. And how did you get started? How did you find your initial investors?
Yes, so initially it started with money from friends and family, basically. You know, I felt that, you know, so I, by this time I was working for a hedge fund, and, you know, I actually had a great experience there in many ways, but I did not have an opportunity to invest the way I really wanted to invest. I always wanted to pursue like true value investing. While I was a fundamental analyst in my prior job, I wouldn't say that we were value investors. And also I didn't really have an opportunity to spend as much time on each investment as I think you have to in order to add any value and beat the markets. And so, you know, I you know, wanted to go out on my own for some time. And you know, when I had an opportunity to start with at least a little bit of money, I took that opportunity, and I'm glad I did.
Right on. Now, we were talking a little bit before you had came on the show that, you know, some of your thoughts about value investing are a little bit different than sort of what the mainstream value investor thinks about. How would you say you're different than just the average value investor?
I think, you know, there are just some I don't think that we're different from all other value investors in these respects that we talked about.
Yeah.
But these are areas where I think there is certainly some disagreement among value investors. I think one, you know, I guess the, you know, the way to classify value investors is often in terms of, you know, are you more of a Buffett or more of a Graham? In other words, do you tend to value quality more, or do you tend to go for like the quantitatively cheap stocks?
Yeah,
that's sort of a, you know, a well-known distinction, and you know, I'd certainly say that we fall more into the Buffett camp. I just think that you know, I see a lot of value investors who I think invest in value traps. Because they, you know, they don't emphasize quality enough in the companies that they invest in. You know, the problems with investing in these quantitatively cheap stocks trading at, you know, half of tangible book value, that sort of thing, that they might be well known to your listeners, like how you have to wait, you know, almost indefinitely for something to happen to cause the price to approach what the value is perceived to be. I also think that you know, a lot of value investors they emphasize ratios like price to book value or price to tangible book value too much, and I think sometimes forget that what it's really all about is the present value of future dividends. That's what gives, you know, an investment its value. And I think with a lot of these investments, both in my personal experience as well as a lot of cases that I've seen, people just they fail to consider, you know, what, you know, how much cash is this business realistically going to be able to distribute to its owners in the future? I think if people took that approach, they would gravitate more towards value, and also I think that the power of compounding is something that really you know, is very powerful. I think everybody sort of conceptually knows that, but still when you're investing in lower quality companies that are not compounding their intrinsic value, you know, you find yourself 5 years later wondering why the stock hasn't gone anywhere.
And even if it has gone somewhere, you could also make the argument that, you know, then you're going to be paying taxes on it when you sell as well. You usually can't hold those companies for 10 years.
You can't hold them for 10 years?
I'm saying you usually can't hold those kinds of companies for 10 years. So you probably end up paying more capital gains taxes too on those as well when you do make money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think another area that, you know, this is one sort of distinct area where I think we're different from, again, a lot of value investors is, and it goes a little bit to this quality versus, you know, quantitatively cheap discussion. I think companies with weak balance sheets make up maybe the single biggest category of value traps, or maybe the second largest category. And I think that's something that definitely think is underappreciated in the value investing community. And it's something that's pretty easy to screen out. We almost never invest in the equity of a company whose balance sheet is below investment grade quality. And, you know, it's interesting. I think that, you know, from personal experience, I've certainly seen a lot of cases where, you know, a company that has that had a lot of debts looked quantitatively very cheap. But, you know, if you took into account, you know, the whole enterprise value, it wasn't necessarily as cheap. You know, that is interesting. I saw some historical return data on the Credit Suisse Leveraged Equity Index, which consists of all the U.S. Companies with high-yield debt rated, so debt rated below investment grade that have publicly traded equity. And they constructed this index going back to 1996, and it has pretty significantly underperformed the broader markets over that roughly 20-year time period. As of fairly recently, that index was up 167% over the last 20 years compared to 380% for the S&P 500. That's a pretty dramatic...
That's pretty significant,
Yeah, and actually, if you look at any full cycle over these 20 years or maybe any trailing 7 or 8 year period, I don't think there's been any periods where it actually outperformed the S&P 500, if I'm not mistaken. And it's interesting because these securities are much more volatile and riskier than the average S&P 500 company.
Yep.
And so it's actually an interesting example of higher risk, lower return.
Yeah, what I find interesting about that too is especially because we've gone through such a long period of low interest rates. You know, I think a lot of people, including myself, might have thought that a lot of those companies would have performed better in that kind of low interest rate environment. Especially when you see, you know, stocks that don't or companies that typically maybe don't have the best balance sheets getting higher valuations than say a company with no debt because they can, you know, refinance their debt at lower interest rates. And it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But I mean, also if you look at, you know, the period from 96 to 06, for instance, I'm also pretty sure that it was the same picture of the highly leveraged companies underperformed the less leveraged companies, even during that time period when interest rates were higher. So I think that people just underestimate how destructive it is when a company goes into bankruptcy and equity investors have a permanent loss of capital. It really works so much against the you know, the power of compounding.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to defeat that.
Now, you were saying before that you only invest in the equity of companies that are, you know, are clearly investment grade. Do you invest in like bonds or, you know, any kind of non-equity positions? Do you ever do any of that?
Yeah, a little bit. We have an extremely flexible mandate at the fund, and so, you know, we invest across geographies, across market caps, you know, from large caps to micro caps, and we will also get involved in debt securities. Although we have almost not done anything in that space, I'd say in large part because distressed debt has been really, really slim pickings in that area since at least 2010. I did spend some time in some of my previous jobs as a distressed debt analyst. So I do have some experience, you know, with bankruptcy investing and just high yield investing. Yeah, that's absolutely an area that we look at, and we've looked at a number of cases. We have had and still do have some sort of special situation fixed income investments in our portfolio. But in terms of distressed debt, we haven't actually done very much. But I suspect that we will at some point, because I think it's a very interesting area. I actually think that in Chapter 11, there's quite often a wealth transfer from the equity investors to the debt investors, which is not fair or right, but I think it does really happen. And I think from my own experiences, there certainly can be some really interesting, very lucrative investment opportunities in distressed debt. And actually, distressed debt has been maybe the best performing hedge fund category over the last, I don't know, 25 years or something like that. I've seen some data to that effect, and that's actually not surprising to me.
What's your process in finding debt securities?
In finding debt securities,
that are potential investments. I mean, there's so much stuff out there. Where do you even start? I get asked this a lot in terms of what my process is. So, and I've never asked other people what their process was. So I'm curious.
Yeah, it's actually a difficult question to answer for me, at least, because we do get our ideas from a broad range of sources. I would say we certainly don't do very much screening. I would say that a lot of our ideas come from, you know, a couple areas. One would be just conversations with other fund managers. I think that can be very productive, and I would also say something that we learned while researching one investment at some point led us to look at some other investments, maybe companies in the same industry or in a related business or something like that. That's often how it comes about. And I'll also say that an important category is I would say, you know, reading the Wall Street Journal. Because I would say, you know, we invest in a few different types of opportunities. One would be like the really underfollowed situation, like a microcap, for instance. Another would be something very complex, like a complex liquidation situation or a complex merger arbitrage or something like that. And the last category would be things that are out of favor. And that's something that you can find just by reading the newspaper or watching the financial news, because, you know, that's usually where that you know, lack of favor is expressed. It's a variety of different sources. Generally we don't have really any problem getting enough potential ideas to look at. You know, another good thing to look at is just online forums. I'd say we generally have plenty of things to look at. It's more a question of really narrowing it down. But it's not quite as structured as a lot of people would like to think. I don't think that's necessarily the right way to go about it.
Yeah, makes sense. And then in terms of your equity positions, are you typically pretty concentrated, pretty diversified? What's your process around that?
Yeah, we're usually concentrated or focused, as I like to call it. Mm-hmm. Currently we have 12 positions in the portfolio. which is pretty typical for us. I would say 10 to 20 is generally what we'll have.
In your your largest position, what percentage of your fund is that?
Largest position is about 15%.
And
we'll rarely get much bigger than that in one position. But I do think that you know, it's just a pretty simple mathematical truth that you know, the more focused your portfolio is in your best ideas, the better your returns will be over time. And I think that's just a, you know, I almost want to say like an easy way to improve your results. You have to do it within reason, obviously. I also think that, so aside from just this simple mathematical fact, I think there are some other things to keep in mind about having a focused portfolio. One is you want to have a focused mind as well. And I think it's too difficult to manage a portfolio that has, you know, 50 positions or 100 positions. It's just not really possible to do it effectively. And if, you know, if you really want to focus your attention and your capital where you can really add some value, I mean, that's how you add value for your investors. That's what you have to do. And so I think, you know, focus, most people understand that focus just in general is important, but I still think it's underrated. And I would just say that, you know, you should never be so concentrated in your portfolio that you're not able to think rationally about your positions. If you become so big in a position that, you know, if it goes down or something happens, you just get so scared, even though you've done all your homework, but just because it's so big and the potential for loss is theoretically so big, if you get so scared you can't think rationally about the position anymore, then it's too big, and you shouldn't let it get that big in the first place.
Yeah. Is there anything, speaking of positions or things you're looking at right now, is there anything that seems interesting that you'd be willing to share on the show?
Yeah, sure. You know, an example of something that we've added to recently is Omnicom. Omnicom is a holding company for a number of ad agencies, PR agencies, and other marketing services agencies globally. The stock has gone down a bit this year, as have the other companies in this industry. So I think it's one of the few areas in the market, especially if we're talking large caps, where there's actually some interesting value at the moment. Omnicom, you know, the business, I think, is really a good business, and I think it's also very well managed. It's essentially like a consulting business in a way. You have almost exclusively variable costs, so with about 80% of operating expenses being labor costs. So even though it's a somewhat cyclical business, these guys never lose money because, you know, their costs are variable. It's also a business that requires very little capital investment. Omnicom's net working capital is actually negative. I think Omnicom also stands out among its peers because it has a better historical organic growth track record than its peers. And more importantly, its capital allocation is really top-notch. They've been much more disciplined acquirers than their peers have historically, and they return so much capital to their shareholders through dividends and buybacks, mostly buybacks. And I think that adds a lot of value. They distribute actually slightly over 100% of their net income. And they do this very consistently and have done this for many, many, many years. So I think it's really a great compounder, a pretty good quality business, and certainly a great high-quality management team. The stock at this point trades at 13.2 times unadjusted trailing net income. If you add back their amortization expense and use, say, a 30% tax rate, which is what I use as a normalized tax rate, it's actually at 11.8 times trailing adjusted net income right now. So, you know, that's at least, you know, the 13.2 times is at least 40% below the S&P 500. And in absolute terms, I think it's a very reasonable price to pay for a good quality business. It's not like a screaming buy, something trading at six times earnings or anything like that. But I think it's obviously very hard to find those kinds of situations in today's markets.
Yeah.
You know, hitting all-time highs. More or less every day. So I think this is an excellent place to put your money in. I think it's actually undervalued in absolute terms, and I think you'll actually earn a very decent return over time on this, and I consider the risk to be pretty moderate.
Interesting. And then was there anything else?
You know, something else that we've sought to invest in for a couple of years, I would say, because the market has been so high, is just anything where the value is generally not going to vary much with the market. So, you know, arbitrages, liquidations, anything where you're not, you know, likely to see much of a beta or anything like that. That's, I would say that becomes more interesting in a market like today's. One position that we've had for a while is Alibaba, which is the new name for Yahoo.
Mm-hmm.
This is a liquidation arbitrage, essentially. Alibaba no longer owns the Yahoo business that was sold to Verizon. At this point, Alibaba owns a 15% stake in Alibaba, 35% stake in Yahoo Japan, which is publicly traded in Japan. It also has a portfolio of patents that were not transferred to Verizon in connection with the sale of Yahoo. They have cash balance of about $9.5 billion, and then, you know, some other very minor assets. Basically, if you add up the assets that they own and you value Alibaba and Yahoo Japan at their current market values, if you value the cash at 100% of its value, the implied discount you're getting on the Alibaba and Yahoo Japan shares by buying Alibaba is roughly 30% today.
Mm-hmm.
I think without a doubt, the new management team is very committed to maximizing shareholder value, liquidating the company, and they're also very incentivized to do so. Their incentive compensation is tied directly to the discount that Alibaba trades at in relation to the its net asset value. And so really the investment is long Alibaba and short Alibaba and Yahoo Japan, so as to only be exposed to that discount between the market price and the value of the underlying assets. And in other words, you're not exposed to the value of Alibaba or Yahoo Japan. As they liquidate, they will owe taxes on the stakes in Yahoo Japan and Alibaba unless they just end up holding them indefinitely, which they might. But with the tax reform proposing a corporate tax rate of 20%, 30% discount does not make sense because, worst case, the company can just sell these assets, pay the gain on pay the tax on the gain, and by the way, the basis they have is close to zero, so they'll have to pay taxes on, well, the gain will be almost 100% of the market value of Alibaba and Yahoo Japan. There are also a couple of I would say sort of free options. One is if they are able to monetize their stake in Alibaba or Yahoo Japan, but probably Alibaba, in a way that does not incur corporate taxes. There's something called a tax hook, which I won't go into detail unless you want me to. But that's something that I think might remain a possibility. If that is the case, then they will really avoid taxes on that gain. And finally, there's a possibility that the stock simply trades at a discount that's less than the 20% that corporate taxes are likely to be. And in that case, you end up doing even better as well. So, you get, you know, essentially like, you know, a little more than a 10% upside from, you know, a roughly 30% to a 20% discount. It's important to keep in mind that you really don't have much capital at risk in the investment because you're hedged by shorting out the Alibaba and Yahoo Japan exposure. So you know, in that sense, the return is much higher. But just based on the market value of the Alibaba shares you'll have to buy, it's only a little over a 10% return in that scenario. But again, very low risk, and it's something that's, you know, should not really be exposed to you know, the high stock market that we have today.
Yeah, interesting. And then when it comes to selling, I know you said earlier in the interview that in the show that, you know, you if you find that the stock isn't cheap anymore, then you'll sell. What's sort of your criteria for that in terms of, you know, a great company that you're invested in that's, you know, good quality being deemed worthy to take a capital gain on?
Yeah, so, I think, you know, when to sell is actually something that sort of bedevils investors more than when to buy, it seems. I think it really should be very simple. The way you decide when to sell is exactly the same way you decide whether to buy. It really should just be based on the discount to intrinsic value. Really, the way I look at it is every day I'm deciding whether or not to be long, you know, each of the securities in my portfolio, as well as, you know, every security that's not in my portfolio. So I think it's very important to optimize your portfolio in that way. always fill up the portfolio with whatever is trading at the biggest discount to intrinsic value. So I would say just with some exceptions to that, one being taxes, generally we'll want to, in fact, in virtually all cases, we will make sure that we hold something for at least 1 year to get long-term capital gain tax treatment for our U.S. investors on the gain. And to some degree, we also try to defer gains. But aside from that, you should really sell the same way that you buy. And so you also mentioned, I think you said high quality investments. You know, when it comes to compounders, of course, the interesting thing is that the intrinsic value ideally continues to grow over time, and so you know, you can find yourself you know, holding it for a long time and making a lot of money on that. So obviously you have to take that into account. You have to update your intrinsic value estimates continuously.
Right. Interesting. Is there anything else that you would like to, you know, talk about or share with the listeners?
I think we covered a lot.
We covered a lot.
It's been a great discussion.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming on. Very interesting. And if you ever want to come back on the show, if you find interesting stuff, you know, more than happy to have you on as a guest again. I really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
Good. My pleasure. Well, anyway, have a great day, Christian, and we'll see you next time.
Sounds good. Thanks.
All right, great. Thanks.
Take care.
You too. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.